Good morning, honorable members. Welcome to the meeting, and good morning also to the officials from the department and ministry. We are now in the process of dealing with a bill, and we would like to finish this within the time frame that we have put ourselves. And then also today we had also said we will do half and half next week. But if possible, if we could do everything today. Yesterday we got a letter that there's an International Women's Conference next week, and as far as possible we should not schedule meetings. So it's Tuesday, Wednesday, so we are affected. But let's see how it goes. We should not rush ourselves. If we are not done, because exceptions also are made for those who are dealing with the bills that are before the committee, we will continue next week if we're not done, and we will join the international conference later. You're most welcome. Barbara will lead us on the version. I think we all have version two of the bill. As tradition, we start by introducing ourselves. My name is Lindwe Masego, chairperson of the committee.
My name is Agnes Stucken, I'm a member of the committee. Thank you.
Nokuzola Ndongeni, member of the committee. Morning.
Good morning, Nick Kornoff, member of the committee.
Morning, Chantal King, member of the committee.
Good morning, Annelie Lotrek, member of the committee.
Srishni Govender, communications.
Good morning, honourable chair and members. I'm Martin Mulcahy, special advisor to the minister.
Good morning, Charlene Munsami from the Department of Science and Technology.
Morning, it's Khunzo Mutobi from DST.
Morning, honourable members, Shumi Pango from DST.
Good morning, honourable members, Carol van Dijk, DST.
Good morning, Yona Sereti from DST.
Good morning, honourable members, Tom Sugnandan from the DST.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson. Good morning, Honourable Members. I'm Barbara Lutz. I'm your legal advisor from Parliament.
Good morning, Members. I'm Renee Osborne Mullins. I'm content advisor for the committee.
Morning, Members. Louis and France, PLO in the Ministry.
Good morning. I'm Tando Tolo Potoman, committee assistant.
Thank you very much. Most welcome. I must also tender the apology of Honorable Matale. He lost his mother, who will be buried on Friday. I think it's been so hard on him.
Yeah.
Because his brother, then his niece, and then his sister, now his mother. The burial is on Friday, and I just spoken to Honorable Gekana to probably represent the committee at the burial, and I just spoken to Shanaz to see if we can, from the funds that are allocated to the committee, to organize a wreath. They talk of a card, but I want a wreath. Fortunately, they do say it's chairperson's discretionary, So with your permission, I think we will organize a wreath and then also ask Honorable Kekana to represent us. We'll also buy a card, and I'll ask Shanaz to go around members later in the day or so, maybe during the sitting, just for members to write a message and sign for that. Thank you very much. Barbara, and also with Renee, our lead ladies. today. Thank you very much. It's over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, committee. With your permission, I'm going to drag Tom in as well, where there is a policy aspect, because we leave that to the department as the executive to respond to. And also apologies, the projection doesn't seem to work. It's too far away. So we have handed out a document with grammatical changes, because we picked up a few gremlins. When many hands work on one document, sometimes that creeps in, and only when you read with fresh eyes you see that. Apologies for that. I will point
Sorry,
out...
Sorry, Barbara, I think also with members, I think you can ask questions as we go, so that then you don't lose it. So let's have just an engaging, and any person from the department who wants to make input or clarification or addition or whatever as we go. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I think that is, because it was such a collaborative process, that is actually the best way. Just as a start, to give members an idea, because there's, I want to almost say there's not a clause that has not been tinkered with slightly, following committee members' comments from public hearings and the instruction for us to go make it a plain language bill that's easily readable and easily accessible. So for that purpose, I did consult with Shanaz as the procedural advisor to the committee. The rules allow for a committee either to do an A list with small amendments indicating that to the House or to do a redraft. For purposes of to keep it as clear and transparent as possible, the proposal is that the committee rather table a redraft than an A-list that will be too really extensive and complicate the process. So with Chairperson and the committee's permission, that's then what we will, following inputs here, prepare as a CREDA a draft. Also then, the basic idea behind most of the proposed amendments is, from public hearings perspective, the concerns raised around NICSO and where it's positioned, and that it should not have too much extensive power that it takes away from the indigenous communities and their ownership and control, as well as confusion with regard to agents accreditation, certification, practitioners. So we try to clear that up with clear distinctions under a heading that deals with recognition of prior learning as something separate to the idea of documenting and databasing indigenous knowledge, to also get that distinction in place, and then obviously structural issues. So with Chair and the committee's permission, on page one with the long title, to bring into the scope, to just the clarity for the bill, a concern was raised with the use of the word systems. So that was taken out throughout the bill, except for where it actually refers to a structure that is in place. And that then is reflected in the long title, as well as bringing in the overarching description of recognition of prior learning as a catch-all phrase for what then is distinguished in the bill. Also, the idea of holders created some confusion because we talk about the community as the owners, the trustees as the custodians, and then you also have license holders when there's benefit sharing agreements. So the idea of holders was taken out and rather clarified as when it is the community, when it's the trustee, and when it's somebody that holds their license. So that was the long title changes. From the index, I'm not going to go through the index, I think, line by line, because that is the titles of every clause. But just for one of the grammatical oversights, Chapter 8 title wasn't inserted, and we just inserted enforcement of rights as a Chapter 8 title there. And a title change that members will note in Clause 30 when we go on for clarity purposes is co-ownership was changed to multiple claims, to just clarify that. So with Chair and the committee's permission, I'm going to start with the definition section. For the access definition, it's what we brought in as a proposed amendment for committee's consideration is just a clarification of natural and juristic persons.
that I almost want to say a legalese standard if you work in legislation to say to have that all encompassing description that it's a natural and a juristic person, and then rather to say facilitated by NICSO instead of holding and controlling, so to soften the access perspective and standardize that then throughout the bill. With regard to the accreditation definition, and that will also similarly reflect in the certification definition, we had a bit of a discussion of almost like what came first, the chicken or the egg, when it came to agents and indigenous practitioners, because you need to be an indigenous practitioner to qualify as an agent, but an agent says or evaluates and recommends to NICSO who should be qualified or certified as an indigenous practitioner. So after long discussions and mutual, I think, board debates as well, the proposal from the definitions that will be pulled through to clause 14 and 15 is that the idea of agent is first addressed as the person who gets accreditation from NICSO to point out or to recommend and evaluate who could get a certificate to be regarded as an indigenous practitioner. The idea for that under the title of recognition of prior learning is in here. Renee can help me because I don't know the technical scopes of science and technology practices so much, but I recall us talking about engineers. You study to get a qualification, your certificate, your acknowledgement, and then you have to get further accreditation to become part of a professional body. So to draw that type of reasoning for prior learning in and to also formalize and give proper professional recognition to the indigenous knowledge practitioners involved to equate to that standard, that's then where the accreditation now is linked to the agent and the certification is linked to the indigenous practitioner.
And then,
I'm just thinking now at this point, and it hasn't bothered me before, but what is the motivation for using the term agent?
Actually, there's no motivation in terms of, we just use the term so that it wouldn't create any confusion in terms of an accreditor or a certifier. So that it was an idea that was mooted by our reviewers. We had a panel of reviewers, and they reviewed the bill, and they suggested that we use the word agent rather than some. It was a very neutral term, but it's not loaded with any innuendos. It's just a very, very neutral. We'd be open to suggestions.
Chair, I'm just worried because to me, on first reading, an agent is almost a go-between or standing for someone to, in Afrikaans, om te ageer. So I'm a bit concerned about the term agent.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. That's precisely what our intention was, as the go between NICSO and the practitioner.
Sorry, but the agent has to assess and verify. So you can't be the go between. If you actually have to now go and assess and verify, an agent can make it possible for it to happen, but he can't be the actual person doing it then.
Can I find out something also? The for instance, the people in Rustenburg, when we were there, those people who go around interviewing people and putting it, are those agents?
No.
Oh, okay.
They are recorded.
Okay, so we have not met agents.
No, I haven't met them.
But on the question of Dr. Lotry, Dr. Select.
No, thank you very much. This is a delegated responsibility to an agent because NICSO cannot be seen to be doing the certifying. So, because NICSO is not a practitioner and NICSO are not knowledge holders. So the practitioner who has the skills and recognized that they are capable of assessing and evaluating are then delegated that responsibility to, and hence the agency. So they are acting on behalf of the body that would eventually give the accreditation, which will be NICSO. So it's an agent acting on behalf of NICSO, because NICSO shouldn't in itself, because it's not a practitioner, do that.
I think what I understand, and also is also coming to bother, is like you say that Dr. Seleti, being the director or something, and then you are employed to do ABC, and then you then bring in Carol, who's the consultant, to help you do what you are employed to do. So I think the word agent seems like you're bringing somebody outside who must help you to do something, instead of, I don't know, but I think it's as Dr. Lotrud says, it sounds more like a go between somebody who's brought in to, you know.
Chairperson, can I just want to go back, you know, to the first. I'll come to this now. But when you say access natural and heuristic persons, don't you think we should have a definition for heuristic person? You know, normally we use legal person, but the heuristic person, you know, is it a partnership? Is it? I know it's everything, but I don't know whether we should put in a definition. You don't need to react to it now. It's just making it easier, because people know what the natural person is, but heuristic person is a company, it can be a partnership, it can be a trust, it can be many things. But, you know, I don't know whether we should go there. I prefer the word legal person, not heuristic. But then, on agent, should we not say, should we not use qualifying authority? Just say, for instance, if we go to accreditation, you see, NICSO grants or delegates authority to a qualifying authority, not to an agent, to assess and verify. And then agent becomes a qualifying authority. Because an agent, it can be a company, it can be an individual, it can be anybody, an agent. So then we must... An agent is like, you know, people think it's an estate agent. That sometimes you say, I've seen my agent, then I've seen my attorney. Obviously, it is a generic term. I'm not against it, but an agent is a qualifying authority.
I hear what members are saying, and the discussion is actually valuable because we get that idea. Can I just make a proposal, perhaps, because we're saying means qualifying authority, instead of agent, then use assessor?
Yeah.
To soften it, to take because agent sometimes does have that legal, my agent will act on behalf of me, but because the person assesses as a qualifying authority, to then rather replace where we say agent with the word assessor.
But I would go with that, because the function is to assess and verify. And what I also want to ask, and I'll get back to that with prior learning, is that within this whole thing, if we talk about any qualifications and certification, we have to get SACWA and NQF and their requirements involved as well. And then an assessor is a much better term than agent.
Can I, Honorable Tuck, and then...
Comrade Chairperson, the way I see it, as an agent. An agent can make or break this process. That's how I see it. Then I would like to know, where do they get the guidelines, the agent then? Do they get it from Mixo, or do they just help themselves? Do they do their own thing? And should Mixo not put a system or a program in place to verify? That is what I would like to know in this case.
But also there's now the issue of the changing to assessor.
To assessor.
Yes, that's my question.
Thank you, Chair. Just a building on that change to assessor, if we talk about a qualifying authority, is it actually intended to say a qualified person? An assessor means a qualified person accredited and assigned by Nixo, because otherwise the Honourable Lutfi's comment becomes relevant that we are talking about an authority. SACWA is the authority. So it's almost a kind of an umbrella term rather than a specific qualified person. An assessor means a qualified person accredited by Nixo.
A qualified person. Mm-hmm.
There's a...
But it can be a juristic person as well.
Yes.
It can be a company. Yeah.
Okay, so we
legal
change
persona.
The assessor and then qualified person. Okay, thanks. Please continue.
So, just to respond to the Honourable Member's question with regard to the standards. In clauses 14 and 15, when we deal with the accreditation and certification, we've made provision for the fact that the standards must be prescribed. So the minister will have that power, because prescribed is defined as per regulation, to then set standards that must be met. So it won't be a free-for-all situation where anybody can come in and claim to be an assessor or to run that process. So the safeguards will be put in place by the department through the minister. Then with Chair's permission, benefit sharing was also a very complex matter, and I think that created a lot of confusion in the public hearings, because all of a sudden there was a list of including, and when you list things, people, even if you say it's not exclusive or inclusive, it creates confusion. So upon reflection and in discussion with the department, benefit sharing has been simplified to have a broader, to focus on the broader monetary and non-monetary benefits that can encompass all that is listed and possibly that develops later or comes to light later. So it's a general phrasing that's not inclusive or exclusive, and just means a fair and equitable sharing of monetary and non-monetary benefits in terms of a benefit sharing agreement between a trustee, who will then act as the custodian of the relevant Indigenous community, and the license holder who wants to use the benefits for a commercial purpose.
Are we fine with that one?
No. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And then with certification, that's then what we spoke about with accreditation then filters through to certification. But certification is then to give that acknowledgement of skills on a professional level to an Indigenous knowledge holder, and that then pulls us into clauses 14 and 15, where the practice standards for such evaluation will be set out. For commercial use, in our discussions, and also because of what was raised during the committee's
okay,
discussion.
There need to be a change on certification. You're using agent or practitioner. Yeah, sorry.
Can you say where everywhere in the document where agent appears to be changed to assistant?
Yeah, we'll do a knock-on effect check throughout and just align that. And we can indicate to members when we present the draft B-bill, we'll highlight where those changes were affected. Then, Chair, with commercial use, the committee's interaction with the public and also the department's response to the public hearings, the word exploitation fell very hard on the ear. It creates a negative meaning that's not the intention of the bill. The bill's intention is to aid and to support and to provide people with assistance and to protect rather than exploit. So the proposal with commercial use is to drop the word exploitation and merely say means the use of indigenous knowledge for financial gain. And then the benefit sharing agreements will set the standards that protect the indigenous community. Then the constitutional definition, the standard, we kept that as is. Cultural and social identity, in line with the idea of simplifying the bill for plain language, anything that was superfluous, that was already defined somewhere else, we kind of just removed. Indigenous community is defined in the definition, so you don't have to say a cultural social identity includes the indigenous community that is a group or culture. So just to simplify that, we streamlined to not overstate what has already been included. And then here I am going to, with curator, I'm going to bat it over to Tom, because also during...
I just need, so that you don't go back, just for members, we find with cultural and social identity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the commercial use, we find with that.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Okay.
Thank you. In terms of changing the word register to curator, we felt that the term registrar was too technical and would have caused confusion amongst the registrar, which is envisaged in the Health Practitioners Act, and the registrar, which is envisaged in all our IPR acts. So that was the first thing. And if you look at the mandate of the registrar in other legislation, it's very, very broad. The mandate of a curator is much smaller, which manages the register. And currently the register, we are uploading information into our register. So it would create a confusion to say now you're going to report to a registrar, but rather to a curator. And in that vein, Chair, is that we removed all referencing to any intellectual property right terminology, and we replaced it with very plain language.
So on the far left side, we would have put new, because this is new. Okay. So are we fine with the curator, honorable members?
Mm-hmm.
Fine. Thank you. Department?
Thank you, Chair. Then with the definition for department, that's just a drafting amendment that we're trying to bring through all legislation to make legislation almost timeless and adaptable. Instead of saying the Department of Science and Technology, in case the department's name changes, to just describe it as a department means the department responsible for science and technology. So that's just a standardization. With no insults implied. I like your name. the discipline and practice definition, we also didn't tinker with the content. That was just a stylistic change. In our very technical language, which is, we call it a sandwich provision. It's a weird thing, but just to make it easy for the reader to generalize or to see the general principles, and then if anything's listed, that's a qualification or an addition to make it an A and B. So for readability, we didn't change anything in the content, we just changed structure.
Honorable members?
Mm-hmm.
Fine, thanks.
Then, Chair, with the inclusion of functional, that was brought in based on the fact that functional is used in the definition of indigenous knowledge. And just to clarify what functional means, it was a proposal from the department side in response to some of the uncertainty in the public hearings, that functional is then defined in relation to indigenous knowledge to mean knowledge that is scientific or technical in nature, to also then cut out any ambiguity or a possible misunderstanding of overlap.
Members? Thanks.
Sorry,
can't we just perhaps scientific and or technical?
Thanks. Chair, then, with regard to the initial explanation of what we streamlined, holders being deleted, because that just created confusion, and we're now, to cut out the ambiguity, we're taking holder out and giving Indigenous community a definition, trustee is a definition, license holder has a definition. So that then, the proposal was to delete holder completely to avoid ambiguity. Indigenous community, as my colleagues from the department explained last week as well, to avoid any conflict between legislation. Mm-hmm. That's the definition that came over from IPLA. The only slight amendment that's an exception that's included is it doesn't change the scope or the impact, but just from listening what the community said, that the one community doesn't want to be subject to another community if they qualify in terms of criteria, to then in sub C that was brought in for structural purposes, just to remove and are recognized by other groups. So that's just for the committee's consideration in light of the public hearing.
Honourable member, fine with that one. Thank you.
With Indigenous and Cultural Expression, Chairperson, that was just also streamlining because cultural and social identity is defined. So that's just the same argument that if it's already defined, we're not going to double define it. We're just using the term as defined. So we didn't tinker too much with the meaning of Indigenous cultural expression, just the structural layout of it.
My turn.
Sorry, that previous clause, Indigenous community, the three sub-clauses, should they not be separated by or, A or B or C? Because at the moment, I might be too technical, but it suggests you must meet all three criteria. But I think the intention is that it should be one of those criteria.
Yeah.
We add or after. Okay, Barbara.
Chair, I think in IPLA it is and, so it's a tick list criteria. So here I'm going to leave it to Tom. We tried not to change too much because of the argument that we don't want to create a conflict.
Yeah, you are correct. It's and.
Wow. A and. And then B, after I pose these expressions, you put end and...
So then it's E, then you must tick all C.
Okay.
It is
end.
Yes,
yes. What's the button?
Chair, we will double check the version that I have as tables, but I will make a note to go double check that. The version that I have here has and. If I can, with the committee's permission, if we are mistaken and it is or in IPLA, we will make it or. But if IPLA has it as and, then for to avoid the... Okay.
It is
I think it was intended as a qualification criteria.
Okay. Dr. Filetti.
Maybe a word, Chair. The checklist sets a very high standard because if you will just put it all.
Tom, can you please press
there
for?
The and sets a very high standard because if we just did all, it makes it easy to squeeze in. What we want really is to maintain a high standard.
No.
And Chair, with your permission, indigenous knowledge, just to point out that that's where the requirement of the definition of functional came in, to take the scientific, to just streamline it, that it reads better, it's knowledge of a functional nature, instead of qualifying functional within, to have a qualification within a qualifying definition already just overcomplicates it. So that was just a structural simplification, and nothing else changed there.
Sorry, check out. What could you ask here?
In terms of indigenous knowledge and indigenous cultural expression, it seems as if you have separated the two, as because in the IPLA it's one concept, indigenous cultural expressions or knowledge. So here you've separated it without the examples that are given in IPLA.
That is also consistent with the negotiations at the IGC at WIPO, so, and they have separated it into three categories.
Okay. And that indigenous knowledge would have been developed within one indigenous community. It wouldn't have been taken from another indigenous, modified into another.
Mm. Chair, what you're talking now is the derivative of the other. So it wouldn't be the origin, it will be the derivative of that.
Let's so we find it indigenous knowledge, members. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's continue, Barbara.
Thank you, Chair. Then with indigenous knowledge practitioners, we, to align with the fact that they need to be certified, we clarified that it means a person who is certified as sufficiently knowledgeable in indigenous knowledge practices to render a related service, subject to Section 15, which then sets out the process for such certification, and relevant prescribed practice standards being met. So to bring that prescription in again, and also that allows for if anything changes in the standards and that needs to be done through regs, that would then be the safeguard.
Member?
Chair, then with license holder, that's where we also try to bring or clarify some ambiguity. We said it means, or proposed, the proposed amendment is it means any person who successfully enters into a license agreement with an indigenous community to use indigenous knowledge. So the license holder, in terms of the clauses that are, or the process that are set out in the clauses below, will have to go through a process to prove that as an applicant he has the permission, or he or she has the permission, they have negotiated, the trustee has been has acted as the custodian, there is a benefit sharing agreement. So it's not just anybody, it's somebody who successfully entered into such negotiations and obtained that that permission to avoid abuse.
Member? License holder? Fine. Mm-hmm.
We kept the meaning of minister, which actually aligns now with the revised version of department. Natural resources and NICSO was kept standard as per tabled, as well as prescribed, which then means prescribed by regulations. With prior informed consent, that also, as Tom explained, comes from an international WIPO standard. So I'll leave that to you.
Tom?
Thank you, Chair. Prior informed consent comes from the Nagoya Protocol, which is a protocol that is born out of the Convention on Biodiversity. So prior informed consent is Article 4, I think, of the Nagoya Protocol, and we've just sucked it out from the Nagoya Protocol and we've embedded it in the Act.
Remember? Fine, thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. Then registration office, just also because the word registration and register was used so often, we thought to define as far as possible. Registration office then means a registration office for indigenous knowledge within NICSO, just for clarification. And then building on that, the register will be the Register of Indigenous Knowledge provided in Section 19, which we kept standard, but then we slightly amended the register of designations, because that's something else. The register of designations speaks to now the assessor and the practitioner when it comes to prior learning recognition. So that's the professionalization of aspect of the act instead of the gathering of information and safeguarding the database. So where the Register of Indigenous Knowledge speaks to the database aspect, the Register of Designations speaks to the professionalization. And then their agent will obviously also change to assessor.
We find with those members. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Regulations in this act, we kept standard. With trustee, we because the trustee doesn't get ownership, we replaced it with custodianship because it carries a fiduciary duty. The trustee acts on behalf of the Indigenous community he or she is appointed to protect. So to take the ownership idea out and then just for to move away from archaic language practices, shall was dropped, and we just rephrased it to modernize it in plain language, but the big change in trustee was to take the ownership element out and say that it's blatantly custodianship.
Marble members, I think there was a lot of issues around trustee, so we're fine. Mm. Thank you.
And then, Chair, just with Honourable Kurnoff's suggestion, then juristic person there can also be changed to legal, if that is the preferred.
You must tell me. What's the new trend in there?
Well, the more simplified, the better. So I think legal can, we can do legal there as well, just to make the carry through the revised act then. Just make a note of that. And then we get to the actual, I want to say, flesh of the bill now. Chapter 2 then is the application and objects of the Act. The section was merely just, the content wasn't changed. It was just changed in terms of drafting principles, because if you only have one aspect that you're dealing with, you don't put a sub 1. You just say clause 2 or section 2 and you put the content in there. So we didn't change the application of the Act. It still applies to persons in the Republic and including the state. And then it the Act deals with Indigenous knowledge registered under the Act, because the registration is voluntary. The Act isn't imposing an obligation on anybody to partake in it, which I think builds on to the discussions the members had in public hearings with the communities. They would like it to be voluntary. The object of the Act then was just rephrased to bring in the accreditation and certification aspect, and just, I want to say, streamlined, written a little bit prettier in the structural aspects, but there was not change to the object of the Act, because that was a policy decision, obviously, from the department. That's how the bill was tabled, and that is the purpose and the aim thereof.
For those who do not know, I'm chairing now, so can we accept that? Okay, we can carry on. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Then with the National Indigenous Knowledge Systems Office, that's the only place where systems is actually kept, because that is it refers to an office and not a structure that is applied to a community. So that's a different system. It's not the generalized system. And that then deals with the establishment of NICSA, which merely, because NICSA is defined in the definition section, all that was taken out there is to rewrite it and put it in brackets, because that's more a contractual drafting style than a legislative drafting style. The functions and powers of NICSA, agents will then obviously again be turned into assessors. It was basically kept the same. I think in H was rephrased, and some of it was brought up from there was a clause that also dealt with functions and powers. There was two separate clauses, and we just put everything that's functions and powers in one. So where members see the red in the middle column, it was just brought up from another clause that it read better as a unit instead of scattered over the bill. Permission check?
Yeah.
Thank you. Administration of Nexo, we kept it the same. We just did a bit of a structural
check. Could I just go back?
Mm-hmm. Mike.
Sorry. To K. Making recommendations to the Minister regarding norms and standards for certification of Indigenous practitioners. So I take it that this would, as I said earlier, again be in line with CHAQWA,
yes.
Those kinds of...
I trust my department colleagues on that. I agree with that answer. Then CLUS 6 is administration of NEXO. It's just because NEXO is within the department, it's established within the department, that obviously draws in the Public Service Act for the appointment of a qualified head of NEXO. And then we just set out broke down the head of NEXO's responsibilities in also bringing in the reporting function. So the proposal with B is must report to the Director General on all matters relating to the management of NEXO. So there's just a natural, as in most legislation, there's a reporting hierarchy to carry that through. Then that's why a sub 3 is taken out, because if you're setting out the responsibilities, reporting is a responsibility. It's not a... It falls up in that cluster. And then we merely restructured sub 4 that then becomes sub 3 with the staffing of NEXO to say that it consists of the number of employees as may be appointed by the minister in accordance with the Public Service Act or seconded from any organ of state as unnecessary to enable NEXO to perform and function.
Sorry, Chair, could I just...
Yes.
If I can take us back to 2A, the top of that page, the head of NEXO, subject to directions and instructions issued by the Director General or the Minister. That almost gives the Minister and the Director General equivalent authority. Mm-hmm. And normally you would say the Minister or the DG as delegated by the Minister.
That's correct. Yeah. That is correct. Yeah.
So just for clarity, then it will read issued by the Director General as delegated by the Minister.
No, I think by the Minister or by the DG as delegated by the Minister. So you don't take it away from the Minister.
Yeah.
Okay, I've noted that, Chair. My focus is just now. Then establishment of the advisory panel. We just clarify that in building on the previous amendments that the Science and Technology Committee did with the overall panel appointments and structures from previous legislation, just to build in the criteria prescriptions. So to highlight that and to have some standardization in the legislation. So it says the Minister may establish an advisory panel based on criteria as prescribed, consisting of a minimum of 5, which is a suggestion that comes from the department, but no more than 10 members on specific matters relating to the objects of the Act. And then sub 2 goes into the broad representation of that advisory panel, which the suggestion from the department was to make it clear and to avoid ambiguity, instead of saying different organs of state, to say different relevant government departments. Because organs of state, there's a lot of debate always. Does it have a broad meaning? Does it have a narrow meaning? So to cut out that level of ambiguity and give clarity. So for chair and the committee's consideration, that's then the proposed amendments, along with just to make sure that in sub 5, if there's an expiry period, that a person can be reappointed for a further period of 3 years, and for knowledge transfer, that the minister may reappoint a core of at least 3 of the members, so that as the advisory panel changes, you have a knowledge transfer, that it's not always just a complete new advisory panel that has to start from scratch. So that's just a practical proposal.
Are we fine with clause 7? My turn? Let me have Honorable Corona.
Can I just say, on the advisory panel, you see different relevant government departments. So surely, if it's official from a department serving as on the advisory panel, they cannot be remunerated.
Yeah.
So we must just make clear that that is the case.
Chairperson, the reappointment of another 3 years, it doesn't say, for me, as I read it there, you can reappoint this person every 3 years, even if it's for 30 years. This is not very clear for me. I would like some clarity on that. Are we going to say 2 terms or 3 terms?
We can add for a maximum of 2 terms as an additional qualification.
The number of lads is like that.
No, that you've made a proposal. They will do.
Martin?
Thank you, Chair. Just exactly that same point. Sub 6 is therefore irrelevant or can't work unless it says despite sub 5, for the sake of continuity, the minister may reappoint a core of at least 3 members. If, for example, all the members have had 2 terms, then they must all step down.
Yeah.
In which case, that clause 6 doesn't work. So it has to be notwithstanding clause 5. The minister may appoint a core of 3.
Yeah. Thanks.
So how long can they then serve? 6 years. Can they then serve maximum of 6 years?
Mm-hmm.
So if you have an exceptional guy, you know, you're not going to find these guys all over South Africa. If you have an exceptional guy, 6 years is nothing. You know, if he's really a knowledgeable guy, he can spend 15 years there and still do a good job. So I think we should leave a discretion somewhere. Otherwise, you can utilize all your good guys in the first 6 years, and you've got nothing left, unless there is training of good guys who can serve on this panel. I don't know, you know, 6 years in a lifespan of 30 years of hard work is nothing.
Especially in the science field.
Yeah,
Chair, suggestion, just talking to Tom then, to bring that discretion in for the minister then with 6 and taking into consideration Martin's proposal, it can read, notwithstanding subclause 5, for the sake of continuity, the minister may reappoint a core of at least 3 members of the advisory panel as prescribed. And then the standard for those 3 to retain that knowledge can then be dealt with in the regulations if members are willing to give that discretion to the minister.
Honourable Tuck, you're fine with that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Then, Chair, with your permission, the role of the advisory panel, we didn't touch at all except for the removal of systems, because that was misplaced there. It was the incorrect meaning. And then moving on to the protection of Indigenous knowledge, there we did listening to the committee members' comments and questions to the public hearings, as well as comments from the public hearings, we took out some of the archaic principles and streamlined it, also to clear up the issue between ownership and custodianship clearly. So that to say that this act, we start off with the proposed amendment merely saying this act protects registered indigenous knowledge, to make that voluntary aspect clear up front again. Then as far as property goes, to retain the tabled policy decision that indigenous knowledge constitutes property within the meaning of 25 of the Constitution, so that there's no ambiguity there either. Then to reinforce that ownership of indigenous knowledge as property vests in the relevant indigenous community, so that there's no argument to be made that that ownership can go to the trustee or anybody else. So that's clearly stated out in three, I want to say, as plain language as possible, as we could come up with. Then we followed that up.
I think that also was one of the contentious issues during the public hearing. Thanks.
Because I think if the people had the consent shares, I understood it, that their ownership is going to be taken away and then they have no control, which is a valid concern if there is any ambiguity in legislation. Then building on that, on the term of protection, we're proposing that it says indigenous knowledge is protected for as long as it meets the eligibility criteria set out in Section 11. Just to, with the same idea as with who can be regarded as an indigenous community, to keep the standard, as I said, high and tight and professional, because the idea is to give professional recognition and to true recognition, that somebody can't come and claim a derivative when it's original. So Section 11 then sets out the criteria to prove originality and ownership. And if the indigenous knowledge ceases to meet the eligibility criteria set out in Section 11, it falls into the public domain with effect from the date of the proven ineligibility. So once somebody, if it's found to be eligible, if somebody else comes with a counterclaim that can prove later that that's no longer true, then that ownership only becomes ineligible from the date of that proof.
Chair's
permission?
Honourable members,
we
find them.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Then the eligibility criteria we kept as is, with just a small grammatical, we deleted cultural makeup, because cultural and social identity, to say cultural makeup or cultural identity is the same, so it was just a grammatical structural tweak that we did there. We didn't change that. The vesting of the rights of indigenous knowledge then builds on the Section 9, or now Clause 9, but we'll read as Section 9 ownership. So subject to the Section 9 ownership, the custodianship of indigenous knowledge eligible for protection vests in the trustee of that indigenous community. And then as per the definition of trustee, the trustee is appointed by the community. So the community keeps that tight rein on whoever is representing them, and that will always be subject to their ownership. The trustee of the indigenous community then holds the indigenous knowledge in trust on behalf of the indigenous community.
Can I just ask, we know our society, and we know that we like to differ. So if the indigenous community cannot see eye to eye, who will be the trustee? So you can prolong that appointment of the trustee for 2 years, 3 years. And, so the community will be, not having the benefit because there is no trustee, or they cannot meet minds on who will be the trustee. I know, it's difficult, but should we not build in somewhere where if there's not meeting of minds on the trustee to see whether, or is it there already?
I'm just thinking out loud, Chairperson, while the members are speaking. That can maybe that can be stated stronger in sub 3, in the dispute, but there's also dispute resolution clause. But I'm just thinking that 3 also captures some sort of protection, because sub 3 says in the event that, and for as long as the indigenous community of the relevant indigenous knowledge cannot be identified and designated. And for that purpose, obviously, the trustee and all of that will fall in there. Okay. NICSO must act as custodian of that indigenous knowledge.
Okay.
So the indigenous knowledge won't be without protection. There is a backup custodianship built into that, and then further on, there is a dispute resolution mechanism as well.
Martin, do you have a question?
Okay. King? I'm just thinking, now that you talk about trustee, shouldn't we also add in there somewhere that it should be renewable year on year to see if they're still happy with this trustee, or at least put some time frame in there? Because it could be that the indigenous community might decide later on they would like to bring in another person.
So we go back to the definition of trustee, or you want to hear? Yes.
Definition. Chair, it does say, I'm just looking now for the, it is the trusteeship, I'm just checking if it's in the, is appointed in terms of the law of trusts. And in terms of the law of trusts, if you're not happy with your trustee, you can replace the person. So if you find that that person is not acting in the interest, if the fiduciary duty has been has not been met, then that the law of trust then filters in, and the community can remove the trustee and replace. Chair, we ended then with sub 3, with NICSO being the backup custodian if there is any uncertainty as to the relevant indigenous knowledge community trustee, and or even if there is knowledge, but there is a situation of it must still be determined who the community is that originated that knowledge. So it's a very broad protective custodianship. Then rights conferred is also subject to built-in protection mechanisms. Is the indigenous community holding the indigenous knowledge, so that ownership has the exclusive right to any benefit arising from its commercial use, to be acknowledged as its source, and to limit any unauthorized use of indigenous knowledge. So that comes in where there's a benefit sharing agreement that the community has the exclusive right then through its trustee to say what will be allowed and what won't be allowed. So somebody can't just come in and say we have an agreement and use it as they want. The community keeps those tight reins on their original knowledge. And then also subject to 3, a person wishing to make commercial use of indigenous knowledge, so the person who at the end wants to be a license holder, must apply through NICSO for a license in accordance with Section 26 that sets out the criteria, and when so applying must indicate the identity of the indigenous community, the place of origin of the indigenous knowledge, and whether prior informed consent of the indigenous community has been obtained, and a benefit-sharing arrangement entered into with the indigenous community. The only exception is built in there is unless the person is actually a member of the indigenous community itself. So if an individual in that indigenous community wants to use it, there can be an internal agreement between the community and the individual, and the community can then set standards for their own community member and its use. So it makes that distinction as well of internal arrangements in the community and respecting the community and how they want to manage their own internal affairs in comparison to somebody from the outside wanting to use it, and that person then needs to meet a very high threshold of, like, I have looked for the community, I've confirmed this is the community, and I can prove I've had negotiations with them and that this is the agreement. Chairperson, then, in sub...
Chair? Just for my own clarity, this, unless the person is a member, in which instance the community may grant permission. Now, that's extremely wide and general. Who will be entering that agreement? That who will be signing it? Because you could have a situation where there is someone from a community who goes to a certain section of the community and they have this agreement, but it's not recognized by the whole community.
Chair, that's a valid point for clarification. We can amend that to say that that individual must then have the agreement with the trustee, because the trustee is the representative of that. We'll put that in. That's very valid. Chair, then, with permission to continue, the changes we made to the subsections thereafter was more just to streamline, to say an individual member of the Indigenous community holding Indigenous knowledge may make commercial use of that Indigenous knowledge in a manner and subject to such terms and conditions as it may deem fit, but we'll make that then subject to the agreement. We'll draw that in there to the agreement with the trustee. So the terms will be documented and formalized. Then, with permission, Chair, one of the chicken and the egg situation that we had with who's assessing and who's accrediting and who's certified is dealt with in Chapter 5. We hope we've made it simplified and taken out the ambiguity. So with a chairperson and the committee's permission, we placed it under, instead of saying accreditation and certification, we changed or proposing the changing of the title to say recognition of prior learning, because that's in effect what one of the aims of the bill is to do, is to give professional recognition to prior learning as a qualified skill, and that then being the basis for somebody to get a certificate to say you are a certified practitioner. Then obviously everywhere where agent is reading now, it will say assessor, but the accreditation then goes to the assessor, and that is through a delegation from NICSA. And as the processes are there, then put in place that everything must happen within a prescribed manner. The minister will, through regulation, set the standards for what is the standards for somebody to be an assessor that can be delegated those evaluation functions from NICSA. But what is important that was put in, Chair, as a also just a general standardization through legislation, is that if a assessor got that accreditation, there may be circumstances that, the same way with a board member or a director, it's a general principle, but there must be some sort of standard to gauge when you can lose your accreditation. Mm-hmm. So that was then brought in to say if there's a false declaration of intention or if the person refused to comply with standards set, or if the person asked a fee that is higher than the prescribed standards, so they're basically exploiting the system to say if Renee's the assessor and I'm the applicant who wants to be certified or the practitioner, and she charges me double of what is prescribed, then she can lose her accreditation. Sorry, not meaning any offense, just the example. And obviously then the standard, if the person undermines the interest of the discipline he or she is representing, and then of the standard qualification always, if the person has been convicted of a criminal offense and sentenced to imprisonment without the option of a fine. Because if the person is in prison, they obviously can't perform the functions of the assessor. That then is the switch. We then, instead, in the initial bill as tabled, the certification was dealt with first, but we're now proposing that the person who actually can grant the certification be established first, just as a logical position.
Honourable Member? Okay, thank you. Can continue, Barbara?
Then, Chair, number 15 then deals with certification of Indigenous knowledge practitioners. It follows the same structure as with agents of assessors, pardon, assessors, but then just putting in place how they go about that processes will be prescribed by the minister as to how somebody applies, what the standard is for such application to then get into the system to be assessed for certification, with similar safeguards being built in also. Within any profession, we used engineers prior. If you do something wrong, you can lose your qualification, your license. So the same here for then the practitioners. Once you've been given a certificate, you need to not make a false declaration, not fail to comply with the standards set for your practice, for your profession. Also, apart from the after the standard, like have been convicted without the option of a fine, there's an additional one that's not in with the agents, because the agent is obviously also a certified practitioner. That's the first step that they have to go through, that a person can voluntarily relinquish practice as an Indigenous knowledge practitioner. So if someone ever decides that they don't want to be that anymore, that option is there, and that builds in the voluntary element of the tabled bill, that nothing is forced. If you ever decide that you don't like the structure anymore, you don't want to be part of this profession anymore, then you have the option of opting out and saying, I'm giving up my certification.
All members? Okay. Continue.
Thank you, Chair. Then with the Register of Designations, that's just to formalize that there is some form of record of everybody that has been accredited as an assessor, has been certified as an Indigenous knowledge practitioner, so that there's some way for the public also to go check, and for the department and NICSA to have a record that nobody can practice, or that protection for the community is also built in, that they know where whether somebody is qualified or not. Then, Chair, with permission, with Chapter 6 then draws the distinction between what was now the prior learning issues now moving on to the registration of the actual Indigenous knowledge. So that's where the documentation and for historic purposes and database purposes, where that comes in. So that's something completely different, and that's in two separate chapters to avoid confusion. People don't read the register referred to under the Indigenous knowledge as the Register of Designations for the professional prior learning recognition. So that's then where the curator also comes in, to avoid that we speak about the registrar. So this curator is the person who oversees that documentation, the database, and the historic knowledge of which original concept or ideas linked to which Indigenous knowledge community, or Indigenous community, which Indigenous knowledge is linked to which community. And that's then where it says that NICSO, as previously established in the department, then from that builds on the structure that NICSO must establish the Registration Office of Indigenous Knowledge. And I think that builds to what my colleagues in the department presented to the committee last week, because those structures are already in place. This is just a formalization of offices already there. So that then just confirms that NICSO is there, and within NICSO, NICSO will then set up that registration office of which the curator will be the head and then function as per the instructions from the minister or the DG as delegated by the minister. The curator of Indigenous knowledge is then also in terms of this appointed as part in the department as part of the, in terms of the Public Service Act standards, because it's a public service, it's in the executive, and the curator is responsible for the control of the registration office then as the head, subject to directions and instructions issued by the Director General, and the minister will be then changed according to what was the previously done. So that suggestion will just then filter through straight to the bill. Just for functional purposes, the curator can then delegate within his or her office powers and functions to people there and permit agents which would be assessors, to act on behalf of the people they then represent for certification purposes. And then for that, building on that, Chair, the Clause 18 then is removed, because that all falls within what can be prescribed and what is set up in those offices.
Okay. Honourable members, Clause 17 and Clause 18, we're fine. Okay. Mm. Clause 18 is deleted.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm.
Chair, then, with permission, Clause 19 then is Register of Indigenous Knowledge. It's just placing a legislative obligation on NECSO to keep the Register of Indigenous Knowledge in a prescribed manner to ensure the security of the register. And then everywhere where it said registrar, we just changed it to curator and incorporated the prior informed consent element that is the Nagoya protocol principle, just so that there is an enacted obligation to keep everything above board and clear and accessible and within a certain standard, to put that responsibility on NECSO to this is the framework of your job.
Board members? We're fine, thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Then with registration of Indigenous knowledge, this is where the functions of the trustee as the custodian of the Indigenous community also becomes important, because the trustee of an Indigenous community may apply to the curator. Yes, I think I've gone through a bottle of wisdom. Reading a bull is your...
Well, the creator created the
Indigenous. we're just following a different line. So the trustee of the Indigenous community may apply to the curator in a prescribed manner for the registration of Indigenous knowledge. And that's now to get... So the trustee as custodian has two functions. To, when it comes to the negotiation of the benefits, with a potential license holder to represent the rights of the community, but also if the community decides and takes the decision that they want their Indigenous knowledge to be in this database and historically documented, then they will say to the trustee, you need to go and apply to NECSO to get us onto that database and to put on record what was our original creation. Yeah. And that then is just subject to an approved application with conditions and limitations as set out in the prescribed form of 11, with that same criteria of you must proof must obviously be provided. So that's just that same level of proof. And then along with that, the curator must, within 30 days after the registration of Indigenous knowledge, issue the applicant, which will then be the trustee on behalf of the community, a certificate of registration in the prescribed form. So the through regulations, the form of the certificate will be dealt with and published in a prescribed form, a notice of registration in the Indigenous Knowledge Bulletin and any appropriate publication, so that there is public acknowledgement of such registration and such ownership of the original idea. I think that goes against the basic principle that just the communication for publicity, transparency, and that anybody then who wants to be to find out who they must enter into an agreement with knows where to go find that information. Then, Chair, with respect, if I can continue on to Section 26, if members are good with Section or Clause 20. The inspection of the register just makes it open to anybody who wants to go look at information. That will obviously, as with anything, be subject to a fee. The fee will be prescribed in terms of the regs, but that there is a form and manner that if I, as somebody who wants to enter into a negotiation or want to go check or I want to commercialize something that is owned by an Indigenous community, that I can apply to have access to those records. Mm-hmm. And that's just then, so I can go to the curator and say, I want to please inspect the register and follow the processes. We didn't change much in the content thereof. We replaced registrar with curator. We just made subsection 2, notwithstanding subsection 1, additional documentation relating to registration of Indigenous knowledge may only be made available to the public if the person seeking access enters into a prescribed non-disclosure agreement. So it's also so that the person can't go and check the register and take the information and run with it. So there's that non-disclosure that if you pay and you get access and you can see, it's not for public use. You can't just go wild with it. You still need to follow the benefit sharing negotiation structure. So that's just a bit of an internal safeguard. Just for judicial purposes, if anything is ever challenged, clause 22 stipulates that.
I remember you find it clause 21. Okay. Thanks.
Clause 22 just makes it prima facie. It's I don't actually know how to make that plain language. Prima facie means at first sight, but the certificates of a curator is to be prima facie evidence. So if somebody has a certificate from the curator that says this is what it means, and they bring that to a court, unless it's challenged, the court takes that at face value because it will have the chap of the curator and all of that. We took the idea of the seal out and the stamp because that was a little bit archaic. It's merely if something is certified by the curator as this is something that was issued or a document that was printed from the register, the court will take it at face value unless somebody says it was falsified and then proof needs to be brought. So that's just standard, I want to say standard judicial operating procedure.
We're okay with that. Prima facie is one of the words that you find well known by everybody. You know, whether you know the legal terms or not, everybody just uses it. Thanks.
I think that's the one Latin term that will survive, even if Latin is no longer a speakable language or spoken language. Then, Chair, the register to be constructive notice and that builds on the same principle of in any proceedings regarding the rights. It is maybe presumed that every party to those proceedings was aware of the particulars in the register because it is now in the register and it has been published and there is open access that somebody can apply to go see it. So it's just a presumption that every party involved knows of the particulars and that any person using the Indigenous knowledge did so knowing that it was registered and that it was a precondition of use that he or she should enter into agreement. so that nobody can say they didn't know. They have ample opportunity once an Indigenous community's Indigenous knowledge is recognized, it's published, and apart from that, the register is open, so nobody can say, oh, but I used it and I didn't know. I had no way of going to find the owner. So that's just an additional presumption that you are presumed to know that you should do that. And then, Chair, if I can proceed to Clause 24.
Mm-hmm. Clause 23 is fine.
Thank you.
Yeah. Clause 24, the amendment of the register, it just makes, because errors do occur, and if somebody picks up the error that there's a misspelling or something wasn't added, a criteria or a full qualification or explanation or description wasn't added, there is the opportunity for something for someone to apply to amend the register and obviously to then bring proof of such error. But to not make it an open and closed situation of we must allow for human error. People make mistakes. So upon receiving an application from an interested person in the prescribed manner and after granting the Indigenous community an opportunity to make representation, then a decision will be made to amend the register. So the register will not just be amended because somebody says to the curator, oh, but this is wrong. Whoever is involved and whoever's rights and interests are affected will be granted opportunity to make representations. And obviously a trustee will come on behalf of the community and say X, Y, Z, and this is our proof, and we contest that. And that then filters into, obviously, also the dispute resolution issues that we have built in. But then once proof has been, or once that issue of amendment has been dealt with, the curator must amend an entry in the register in accordance with any finding of a court. So if that dispute or that issue escalates to a court decision, obviously the court decision has been final, and that instruction will be implemented by the curator.
Just say finding by a court or a court of law, or just is it fine, just court?
We can make a court of law, but
let me find out from members. What is your view?
So
it is the amendment.
Dr. Slater?
I'm wondering if we say court of law, whether it leaves out the traditional courts and customary courts.
Yeah.
So to an extent, if we put it, we exclude the customary courts that they have.
Okay. So we leave it as a court. Members, Clause 24, you're fine. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Then Chapter 7 deals with the commercial utilization of Indigenous knowledge, which then deals with product development and services and processes. So, pardon, NICSO may, we kept that basically all in place except for the structural changes that we made in Clause 2, sub-clause 2, to just make it that sandwich provision again, and then taking out Sub 3, that was in order to exercise any rights in respect of Indigenous knowledge under this Act, the holder shall register the Indigenous knowledge in terms of Chapter 6, because that registration is implied, it is there. Mm-hmm. It was a restatement of something that's already been obligated. Mm-hmm. So we didn't change anything in 25 except for taking out the duplication.
Okay. Honourable members?
Fine. Then, members, Clause 26, Chair, deals with the access to and use of Indigenous knowledge. We also didn't change the content except for bringing in license agreements with the trustee of the relevant Indigenous community to make sure that the person who enters the license agreement knows that it's the trustee that is the custodian that they need to negotiate with, or then by default, if there is no trustee, and then it will be NICSO as the custodian. And to avoid the idea that NICSO has any over control. It's merely to say as facilitated by NICSO. So NICSO is not the the deciding factor there, unless now they are the custodian, because that, but then they're acting in it with a different hat. So they're not driving the situation, they're merely facilitating the access and use negotiations. And then further, we just said we replaced standard benefit sharing agreement just with license agreement, because that then, and functional as was defined in the definition clauses. So we're just pulling through for consistency purposes the definition meaning.
Yeah, I think the issue of NICSO facilitation function will make them more comfortable, because it was one of the areas that was had some contention. Yeah. Thanks. Mike?
Thank you, Chair. I'm just thinking about this non-exclusive license agreement. Supposing the trustee is in negotiations and in order to commercialize indigenous knowledge is going to require very significant investment, is no one likely to take out a license if it's non-exclusive? So I'm just wondering why that is put in there as a non-exclusive licensing agreement. Is it necessary?
Chair, I think maybe to because everything in the bill is voluntary, perhaps then to facilitate Martin's concern, which I logically see, we can maybe just say enter into a non-exclusive or exclusive license agreement, so that the community has the flexibility and that control again. Okay.
Yeah, because if it's exclusive and non-exclusive, so it removes both and leaves it.
Okay. So just enter into a license agreement. Okay.
And the license agreement can stipulate whether it's exclusive or non-exclusive.
Yes, and as Tom pointed out.
Can.
The license agreement can indicate whether it's an exclusive agreement or a non-exclusive agreement.
Dr. Lutri?
I'm just wondering if I read this clause as, for example, someone who's now be interested, and it says apply in the prescribed manner for a license authorizing. What indication do I have? Where do I go to? I know it says as facilitated by NICSO, but it's still very vague to me as someone now who wants to go and use this.
So she's bringing in the one-stop shop issue. Okay.
Chair, I think that's why we brought in the why the department, not even that's why the prescribed manner is there, also to filter into what member said with regard to standardization of your standards for accreditation and certification, to make that all in the regs quite clear, because that also I think requires some consultation and crafting and discussion. So if you apply in the prescribed manner, the definition clause says that through regs, the person will then have to go check in the regulations what the process is. That also allows, regulations also allows for if time changes and requirements changes, that can be easily adjusted to fit the community as well as the license applicator, the person applying for the license needs. And then you don't need to have a constant legislative amendment that can kind of stall such negotiations. I don't know if that explanation.
I'm just now thinking, as someone who would like to apply for this, that if I read prescribed, it doesn't refer to the regulations as such.
All prescriptions are with the regulations.
Okay, but can one not somewhere indicate that?
Chairperson, we said in the definition, prescribed means by regulation.
Okay.
So that is then, so everywhere that prescribed is mentioned or used in the legislation, it implies regs.
Okay.
That then, if Chair and the committee is fine with clause 26, with the we didn't change much except for drawing through the definitions to say license holder, because license holder is now defined, the form the functionality, the license agreements, and we kept everything else. And then I've made a note of the fact that it is entered into a license agreement and not a non-exclusive.
Yeah.
Are you fine, honourable members?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Also then, Chair, we created proposed a Chapter 8 specific regulation for enforcement of rights, that it is something that's separate and that can be easily identified. So if somebody wants to specifically just check for dispute resolution issues, that is in a separate chapter now. So it's not, it was in the Act, it's just restructured to be a chapter on its own, because it's a standalone issue that that can overarch many of the issues that are raised. It empowers the Minister to set up a dispute resolution committee. And the only thing that we changed was the archaic structural, to not say shall, but must, and where may is required, may sanction, because that's empowering. So we built in the plain language, new standard drafting style, but didn't change anything from the policy as tabled.
Clause 27, honourable members, we find. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Then 28 deals with offences and penalties. That's basically to safeguard against a person who's now a third party, because a dispute resolution issue will resolve issues that between the parties in an agreement. But you need to safeguard against chance takers. That use something, they're a third party and they're not part of that agreement, but they do something wrong. So for offences and penalties, it's proposed that it reads, any third party who knowingly makes commercial use of Indigenous knowledge in a manner which is not in accordance with an agreement entered into with an Indigenous community and infringes the rights of that Indigenous community is guilty of an offence and on conviction liable to pay a prescribed fine. Because the reason behind the benefit-sharing agreements is for the communities to actually benefit from the use of their Indigenous knowledge and property. So if somebody did make use of that and there's been a finding that person did so illegally, then he or she will be liable to pay what he's owed. And that's then, in the prescribed fine. So that's then the fines will be...
Is it determined by whom?
By through regulation. So that can be adjusted as time goes by, because if you set the fine in legislation currency fluctuates, it might change.
To pay a prescribed fine as determined by the minister or by regulation. Otherwise it hangs in the air.
Mm.
Is it not a criminal offence? Is it just a civil sort of offence?
Civil.
criminal, stealing. Because you'd be stealing.
Chair, I'm just thinking also here, it must also be in line with copyright and patent law, and there you have fines and not any sentences to go to jail or anything.
Yeah.
Chairperson, maybe just Honorable Kurnoff's question. Prescribed is there, but we can maybe just rearrange the sentence to say is guilty of an offence and on conviction liable to pay a fine as prescribed to move the prescribed to the end of the sentence that it's the qualifier.
Yeah, fine.
Okay. Then, Chairperson, with permission, I'm going to let hand over to Tom to speak to the transnational arrangements.
Chair, the transnational arrangements is taken directly from the Nagoya Protocol. South Africa, we ratified the Nagoya Protocol in 2013, and now it's become an obligation for South Africa to put in place mechanisms, and hence we've included the transnational issues into the bill. We envisaged three situations in transnational. The first one was national treatment. The second one was reciprocity. And the third one was most advantaged country. Why we did the national treatment is that currently we are negotiating a protocol. So when member states are part of a protocol, the national treatment sets in. For example, we have the Berne Convention. And if South Africa is a member of the Berne Convention and Zimbabwe is the member of the Berne Convention. So if you take a copyright in South Africa, your copyright is also protected in Zimbabwe. So that's national treatment. So currently for indigenous knowledge, we don't have a protocol where countries are either ratifying or acceding to that protocol. So then we use reciprocity, where we get into an agreement with Zimbabwe to say, you will protect the indigenous knowledge and I will protect yours. So that's an agreement between the two countries. So that's essentially what transnational or transboundary issues are. Thank you, Chair.
We're fine with that explanation. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Then, Chair, with Clause 30, that's when I went through the index, I indicated we changed co-ownership there to multiple claims to indigenous knowledge because that spoke more to the content of the section. Because there is the possibility that there may be multiple claims to indigenous knowledge. Based on our country's history, communities were split. They may have migrated to different areas due to circumstances. So two communities can arguably claim ownership to the same indigenous knowledge because initially they were one community. So there is the possibility where there can be multiple claims. So to allow for such circumstances where there are multiple claims to indigenous knowledge, any remuneration payable under a benefit sharing agreement must be apportioned equally among the trustees who then will filter it back into the communities of who they are, the custodians. And if it comes to light that a relevant trustee to such a multi-claim situation is not there, sub 2 then allows for where an existing benefit sharing agreement in terms of section 1 of subsection 1 does not include all the trustees of the relevant communities, that agreement must then be so amended. So it's just because facts can come to light later that changes the circumstances that influence that benefit sharing agreement, and to not unfairly exclude a community who has a similar equal claim to the origin of the knowledge or the creativity.
Where says then the table under the benefit sharing agreement must be apportioned equally among the trustees? Won't the indigenous community be weary of it's like you leaving everything to the trustees and leaving them out of something?
We can maybe put in as custodians as a qualification.
Chair, the general rule is that a trustee cannot take a decision without consulting the community, and that we call it a community resolution, and it's currently in practice with the DR regulations. So what we can also put that into our regulations as well.
We find close that, okay.
Then, Chair, with regard to regulations, we did not change anything. That's as tabled, and that's the standard practice regs in most, all legislation gives the Minister the power to issue regulations to actually make the Act implementable and to give effect to where so prescribed. Then, Chair, with submission, the effect on other laws, I think that was part of the discussion of last week's meeting. So I'm just going to recap in stating that the way that it's phrased now, and we now have it on record that DTI has said there is no conflict. They've given the bill its blessing. The Act does not alter or detract from any rights or in respect of a statute or common law. It deals with something that's complementary. So the effect of laws we've taken out, or we're proposing taking out subclause 3 because it creates unnecessary confusion. So just to say it doesn't add or alter or detract from anything else, the legislation coexists. And then if the committee is fine with that one, because I didn't think at all as per last week's presentation on that. I didn't dare.
Fine. Close this to 2. Okay.
Then the transnational arrangements.
Transitional.
Sorry. Transitional arrangements. I'm reading over my own words. I'm sorry. Transitional arrangements. The only proposal is that to not have the bill, once it's enacted, function in an exclusionary manner, to delete in sub 1 the within 12 months of dates of commencement, that if somebody wants to register, they have 12 months from commencement. Because you don't want to limit the effect of a piece of legislation that's actually there to protect. So if somebody comes across information, maybe Tom can explain better.
Yes, Chair. In terms of the nature of indigenous knowledge, for example, if this generation refuses not to register and the next generation sees the worth or the merit in it, then they would be unable, in terms of the legislation, to register there. So if we limit it to 12 months, it'll be very limiting. So hence we've decided that we'll leave it open. So at any point in time where you feel that there's merit in the registration, you can do so.
Dr. Leite, you can talk.
No, I was also indicating, Chair, that indigenous knowledge is dynamic and evolving. So if you put a limit to that, it will freeze it. Mm-hmm. And so you must leave it open.
And then, Chair, as per your wishes, we've gone through all the clauses, and the final one is clause 34, which is the short title. that will just drop the idea of system, and then as per just practice the date ticks on. Legislation was tabled in 2016, but when it goes out, it will be 2017. So that's just reflected in the short title and commencement. So we're just proposing the deletion of system.
Thank you very much. I'm sure Papra enjoyed working on this film. You may even consider doing a PhD because that you've become so knowledgeable. And I think the you know, this presentation it reminded us of the bill itself and simplified, clarified, and it was actually very, very exciting and interesting. So before I continue, Dr. Seleti, you want to say something? I'm sure even yourself and everybody, Martin, the department, the process, and especially the amendment process, you know, broadened your horizon, and you know, on this whole thing, the public hearings, you know, brought in issues and areas that probably you never thought of, and I think it was very, very helpful. Dr. Seleti.
No, Chair, thank you for the opportunity. I wanted also to commend the leadership of the committee, because without your leadership, we wouldn't have had these kinds of depth with which we have. And also, you've commented on the simplicity. This bill is meant for ordinary citizens. So the clearer it is, the better. And I think that we will commend your leadership, but also the technical team for the expertise that they've brought. And I think we all agree that it is a better piece of legislation than when it was brought to the House. And we thank you for that. I thought I should also mention one thing, maybe as an opportunity. You can see the presence of Martin here and the ministry is not just the department. The ministry is very highly interested in this. And so the political commitment to seeing it through is very strong from our department. And maybe the last bit is that we have sent you an invitation to the IKS Expo to be held in Mpumalanga in September 26 to 28. The previous committee had the opportunity of gracing several of those. We feel that this will give you the ambience and opportunity to see the vibrancy of the community in terms of IKS, because we bring in indigenous knowledge holders, we bring in also academics, and we science councils. So it is really all stakeholders that are involved in it. So it will be taking place in Mbombela, and we have sent the invitation to this portfolio committee, but also to the select committee, since this will be going on. So I just wanted to put that would really appreciate your gracing the occasion. Thank you.
I've already diarized it. and Shanaz will also factor it into the oversight process of the committee. So it's a yes, it's a definite for the committee. But thank you. Martin, do you want to say?
Thank you, Chair. Also, just to reiterate exactly what Professor Seleti has said, is that I think this piece of legislation has been significantly improved through the interaction of your committee and of the honourable members, and thank you very much for that.
Yeah, I think I want to also thank everybody for taking us to where we are. I think also the patience of bringing everybody on board, so that whatever gap that is there should be filled, and giving everybody an opportunity. I hope also that the select committee, when we send it to the NCOP, will, because we had also promised some communities that it's still coming to your province. So I think it will be important to for the delegates of provinces to make sure that such public hearings and opportunity for the community, so they will have it easier, because I'm very happy and excited about it. But thanking members for the robust engagement on the bill itself to get it where it is. Barbara for bringing in a legal mind and working very hard with the team on it, and Renee, she even worked on it when she was on maternity leave. So in the labor ward, she was just thinking, just come out quick, man, I need to deal with this bill. Yeah, the department itself, process led by also Dr. Seletti, Tom, everybody. I think the collaboration with the portfolio committee working together made it easier and exciting. And we most of us came for the first time to interact with indigenous knowledge, the real thing. And as you sit, and I remember when we're at the department reflecting back, you find that some of us do have that indigenous knowledge that you might also apply for deposits, some of them. But it really opened one's mind and thinking and understanding, you know, and reflecting on what is meant by this indigenous knowledge. Because some of the things, it's like even us at this level, we're taking for granted. And so the importance. And when talking to other people outside, people are very excited about this bill. When we went to the symposium in the UKZN, it was very interesting, you know. And actually, there is so much knowledge there ready that I was saying I should consider doing my PhD in IKS in UKZN, because at least there's ready material that you can use for that. But thank you, and also Dr. France for the facilitation with the department. Sometimes we were not direct fighting with the minister, but our anger directed at you. So as to how you put it the other side, it was your baby. But thank you very much. I think so. Renee, the team will then work on the proposed amendments of the amendment, and we'll send it to us. So, because it is clear that then we don't need to meet next week, we'll then do the other thing. So when we meet, sorry, on the 6th, we can have these in a bill form, mm-hmm. so that then we see the real thing and
finalize.
Yeah, and finalize it there. But thank you very much. Honorable members, I want to give you an opportunity to anyone who wants to say anything. Okay, fine. Thank you. Or from the department, Carol, and this thing, show me, it's been your baby. Yes.
I wanted to make one assurance, Chair. We will not let you down after you've enacted this, because we've already started working on some draft materials. We've already beginning to pilot areas which we haven't really done work on, such as the recognition of prior learning, so that by the time the process is finished, we'll be ready to run. So that one, we want to assure you that this is not a bill that will collect dust.
I think this bill also was our baby. Mm-hmm. And I think we will, with our hawk's eyes, deal with the oversight thereof. Mm-hmm. So that we, as you say, that we ensure that it is a living a document. It gets down to the people. It has been simplified, but we make sure that we all run with it. It's our baby. and we want to see it grow and stuff like that. Thank you very much. I don't know.
Fine.
We don't have any
announcements.
Okay. So I think that then brings us to the end of the meeting. Once again, I want to thank each and every one of you sitting around the table and on the side for your contribution, for making this bill to be a reality, for the engagement, for taking our comments, and always being there. Thank you very much. So Shanaz will inform us of the venue for the next meeting. So this meeting is now adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yo, I've taken a part now.
That's just a sticky part. Thank you very much, Honorable Kurenov.